Shoot, shoot from Count Lube's Songs of the Auvergne, sung by Victoria de los Angeles, with the Lamoureux Orchestra, conducted by Jean-Pierre Jacquia. And that's all for today. Rob will be back next week, and on the bill of fare is a collection of unusual toccatas from composers as diverse as Sveilinck and Vaughan Williams. And Rob will also begin a mini-series exploring Bach's solo cello suites. I'm James Jolly, and I hope you've enjoyed my choice of music this morning. Have an enjoyable remainder of your weekend, and I hope this week brings you some great music making and perhaps a few discoveries too.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
The BBC National Orchestra and Chorus of Wales are joined by soloists Ellen Manahan Thomas and Roderick Williams to perform one of the most cherished choral masterpieces, Fauré's Requiem. Join Nicola Haywood-Thomas from St David's Hall, Cardiff, for Live in Concert, Friday evening at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And now Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the biologist Lewis Wolpert.
Lewis Wolpert is a distinguished scientist and a familiar, lanky figure on his bicycle in Bloomsbury, travelling through the traffic to University College London, where he's Emeritus Professor of Biology. His scientific research has been into the early development of the embryo, but he's a man with many other interests. He's written books about depression and recently a book about getting old. And he's currently bravely embarking on a book about the biological differences between the brains of men and women. He's a man unafraid of controversy and unafraid of the London traffic too, Lewis, because when you're on your bike, you're firmly plugged in, I think, into your MP3 player with your headphones on. So what kind of things do you tend to listen to when cycling?
I'm ashamed to say that I have on my iPod 741 different tunes, and I just let the iPod choose them randomly. So I don't mind what comes on, because I've chosen them, it means that I like them. But I love it. I love listening while I'm cycling. People say, isn't it dangerous that you're listening? On the contrary, it's not that I can't hear the traffic. On the contrary, the traffic interferes with my music sometimes. And I am someone who likes listening to music when I'm working at home. Radio 3 is on.
I was thinking that the first piece of music, which is by Noel Coward, one of his famous ones, could be a title for all those who venture out on the London roads on a bicycle.
I don't really think that's the case. I'm not frightened. I've always found the British drivers or London drivers have been really very nice with me, and I very rarely have an incident where I'm frightened. Very, very rarely.
Well, I think you probably cut such a formidable figure that motorists say, be wary. So tell us about why you've chosen Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Because it's so funny. I think Noel Coward is so brilliant, and I find this particular song so amusing. Also, I identify very strongly with dogs, too. My partner basically treats me like a dog, looks after me extremely well, and I had dogs when I was very young, and I love dogs, and I identify with them, and I think this is just such a brilliant and witty song.
Tropical climes for certain times of day, when all the citizens retire to take their clothes off and perspire. It's one of those rules the greatest fools obey, because the sun is far too sultry and one must avoid its ultraviolet ray. The natives grieve when the white men leave their huts, because they're obviously, definitely nuts. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The Japanese don't care to, the Chinese wouldn't dare to. Hindus and Argentines sleep firmly from 12 to 1. But Englishmen detest our siesta. In the Philippines, they have lovely screens to protect you from the glare. In the Malay states, there are hats like plates which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 noon, the natives swoon and no further work is done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. It's such a surprise for the Eastern eyes to see that though the English are effete, they're quite impervious to heat. When the white man rides, every native hides in glee. Because the simple creatures hope he will impale his soul a topi on a tree. It seems such a shame when the English claim the earth that they give rise to such hilarity and mirth. Ha 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 ha. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The toughest Burmese bandit can never understand it. In Rangoon, the heat of noon is just what the natives shun. They put their scotch or rye down and lie down. In a jungle town where the sun beats down to the rage of man and beast, the English garb of the English Saab merely gets a bit more creased. In Bangkok, at 12 o'clock, they foam at the mouth and run. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The smallest Malay rabbit deplores this foolish habit. In Hong Kong, they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps where the python romps, there is peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, for there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday, 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 out in the midday sun.
Noel Coward's song from 1931, Mad Dogs and Englishmen. Let's pursue your canine affinity. What do you do to be treated like a dog by your partner?
She tries to keep me clean, and that's quite hard. In other words, she wants me brushed and washed and tidy. And we dogs have some problems with that. She doesn't like me contradicting. Not that dogs contradict, but if dogs could contradict, then I'd be that sort of dog.
But she's affectionate and you
wag
your tail.
Oh, she looks after me. I've just had a hip operation. And so she's looked after me with great care, and I'm very grateful for how kind she's been to me.
Well, I suppose that's a quintessential song, that Coward song. How do you think of yourself, born in South Africa, and you found yourself living in this country? Do you think of yourself as English now?
I'm afraid I don't think of myself as English. I'm British by birth because my father was born in Ireland. So I am British by birth, but I'm not English. I'm still South Africa. I'm a Londoner, but I'm not English. And I think it's partly because the English class system somehow impedes on my wanting to be English. No, I'm still South African after all these many, many years. I'm not English. I don't easily suffer from embarrassment and things like that.
Well, I'm looking forward to the next hour on that account. You said that you left South Africa because your parents wanted you to be a nice Jewish boy. What was it that you were perhaps rebelling against? I mean, was it the Jewish faith or simply being nice or both?
I wasn't anti-Jewish. I was Jewish. I wanted to leave South Africa partly because of the politics. I was quite involved with politics, with Mandela and so forth. But they wanted me to be a respectable Jewish boy. And I wanted to get away from that because I was behaving moderately wildly. And coming to London eventually, I ended up in Soho in the 50s, and that was magic.
I think by way of introduction to our next music, you were introduced to this yourself by somebody who took you to concerts in Israel, an older companion.
She was an older companion. I knew the family, and I occasionally stayed at their house. But she was a very beautiful woman, and she used to take me to concerts, particularly quartets. And when the themes changed, she would, give me a pinch on my thing, and she was beautiful and clever, and I learned a lot about music from her. I just do like Beethoven quartets. I like the cleverness, I like the themes, I like the music.
Thank you.
I must say I can see why I love it. I haven't heard it for a little while, but it's so brilliant and it's so beautiful.
It's a late work, of course, by Beethoven, one of the Opus 130 quartets, number 13 in B-flat, performed there by the Lindsay Quartet. Your book, You're Looking Very Well, The Surprising Nature of Getting Old, do you think that that music in any way speaks of being late, or in fact do you think it completely defies that and could be by an 18-year-old?
From my ignorance, I would say I couldn't possibly tell. I wouldn't have thought an 18-year-old could write it. I know you're a composer. Could you write that when you're 18-year-old?
No, and not probably when I'm 80-year-old either. Because people do, I think actually not that movement in particular, but in some of the quieter, slower movements, people sort of feel that this is someone absolutely coming to terms with music, deafness, all of those things. But of course, the great beauty of music, and the reason why in one sense this programme is impossible, is that we're trying to talk about music in another language when in fact the music defies description.
I think that's true. I think describing music is very difficult. I agree with you entirely.
Much easier to describe dogs, in fact.
Far easier. Being a dog myself, I can talk about myself interminably.
The next music we're going to hear comes from a musical. Why did you choose this?
Well, it was suggested to me because I'm writing a book on the psychological differences mainly, or the biological differences between men and women. And when I heard the music, I thought this is absolutely terrific, and I have chosen it as the title for my book, which I have drafted but was just not yet published.
Well, let's turn to My Fair Lady for enlightenment.
That's all there is to that. Their heads are full of cotton, hay and rags. They're nothing but exasperating, irritating, vacillating, calculating, agitating, maddening and infuriating hags. Pickering, why can't a woman be more like a man?
I beg your pardon?
Yes, why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so honest, so thoroughly square, eternally noble, historically fair, who when you win will always give your back a pat. But why can't a woman be like that? Why does everyone do what the others do? Can't a woman learn to use her head? Why do they do everything their mothers do? Why don't they grow up? Well, like their father instead. Why can't a woman take after a man? Men are so pleasant, so easy to please. Whenever you're with them, you're always at ease. Would you be slighted if I didn't speak for hours?
Of course not.
Would you be livid if I had a drink or two?
Nonsense.
Would you be wounded if I never sent you flowers?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like you? One man in a million may shout a bit. Now and then, there's one with slight defects. One, perhaps, whose truthfulness you doubt a bit. But by and large, we are a marvelous sex. Why can't a woman take after a man? Because men are so friendly, good-natured and kind. A better companion you never will find.
If I were hours late for dinner, would you bellow?
Of course
not. If I forgot your silly birthday, would you fuss?
Nonsense.
Would you complain if I took out another fellow?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like us? Mrs. Pierce, you're a woman. Why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so decent, such regular chaps, ready to help you through any mishaps, ready to buck you up whenever you are glum. Why can't a woman be a chum?
A hymn to him from the soundtrack to the 1964 film My Fair Lady, sung by Rex Harrison as Professor Henry Higgins, with asides from Wilfred Hyde White as Colonel Pickering. Music by Frederick Lowe and words by Alan J. Lerner.
It's worth pointing out Nor is that only misleading, but from a biological point of view, men are basically modified women, because if you look how embryos develop, they really develop as women and are slightly modified to turn into a man. And that's why, for example, men have breasts, because that's where we come from. We actually are modified women. Intellectually, there's no significant difference whatsoever. There are a couple of skills like interpreting 3D images at which men are better than women, but otherwise there isn't a great deal. When it comes to illnesses, there are quite a lot of differences between men and women.
Like?
Well, multiple sclerosis is much more with women than men. And the immune system in women leads to much more illnesses than it does in men.
You have four children yourself, haven't you? Lewis
four Warbert. Children, yes. Mm. Four children under five we had.
Good Lord.
Yes, that's what I say. I don't think I was a terribly good father.
And those were boys and girls, weren't they?
Two girls, two boys.
Yeah. And so did that bear out the kind of conclusions you're coming to in your book?
Funny enough, when I think about the book, I never think about the children, because they are really, each one has its own special qualities, yes.
The next music, I think, is a wonderful piece. And it's interesting that you had the Beethoven earlier, because for me, the Bartok quartets are the greatest set of quartets since Beethoven. And I think he was in these quartets. He was experimenting with string technique. He was pushing his language forward. And I think it's that sort of quasi-scientific development that rather interests you here.
I also think, whereas I could see the themes easily in Beethoven, quite easily, with Bartok, I spent a lot of time trying to identify them, and therefore I spent a lot of time listening to Bartok.
But it does reward
that
work.
Oh, it's very rewarding, absolutely.
This is from String Quartet Number 1, part of the first movement.
Thank you.
Well, complicated music.
It speaks to me of a glimpse inside a very personal vision, quite profound, quite argued, and quite complicated and turbulent.
It is complicated for me.
But in the right way. It's not alienating, I don't
think.
No,
it's not alienating.
In fact, I think it sort of embraces you if you allow yourself to enter the world.
Sure.
The first movement of Bartok's String Quartet No. 1 in A minor, Opus 7, played by the Takash Quartet. We've talked about the problems of sort of scientific research, Lewis, but I can't help wondering if for you there's still a sense of amazement when you discover things, or just working out how things in fact happen at all.
I am amazed. You see, my subject is development. And the fact that you and I come from a single cell, and so do all people, that's my subject. And although we understand quite a lot about it, I'm still amazed by it. I'm amazed by evolution, of the variety of animals and plants that we have in the universe. I just find it mind-blowing at times, yes. When we get onto the complex things about physics and so forth, I'm a bit out of my depth. But I do find biology absolutely astonishing.
And you realise that you've just encapsulated the quality of that Bartok first movement because it all grows out of a single sort of cell.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And how our brains work, we have a long way to go.
Interesting that composers, especially composers of real quality, I think, like Beethoven and Bartok, take something that has a corollary, if you like, in science, that they take a group of notes and then they turn them upside down or they run them backwards. They treat them scientifically to milk them, if you like.
I don't think it's science that they're using. I really don't. Sorry. I don't think there's any relationship between science and music.
You think it's intuition?
It's all their cleverness, you know, their manipulative skills, but I don't think it's anything to do with science.
But there's an element of mathematics in music.
I haven't thought of that. There may be an element, but you mean because of the different tones and so forth. But
Well, in terms of constructing rhythm or in terms
Yes, but I don't think that leads to significant composing.
It's interesting, because if you take a composer like Bach,
yes,
who for some people sounds mathematical, though I think actually once you get to know Bach, it's incredibly a wonderful marriage of the cerebral and the heart. But I can see why to some people that sounds quite scientific.
I just like to keep science away from the arts. No connection between them.
We're going to hear a love song next, and I think one with a personal resonance.
Yes. Can I explain why I've chosen this? Because when I was a student at university in South Africa, I went to a meeting in Cape Town, and I shared a train compartment with someone studying law, and he taught me this song. It's one of the few songs that I used to sing 75 or 70 years ago. And Frank Sinatra sings it so beautifully, I couldn't resist choosing it.
And does it have any resonance for you with any of your partners?
I'm afraid not. It's purely self-indulgence that this was one of the few songs I learned to sing quite well at an early stage.
But of course,
I can't sing well. It is nonsense.
I was forgetting, of course, that your relationship with the women in your life has a very canine bent to it, so it would be the other way around anyway.
But it's a wonderful song, and I think Sinatra is amazing.
Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me, my silk and laceable you. I'm in love with you, I am, and verily so. But you're much too shy, unnecessarily so. many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms about you. Don't be a naughty baby. Come to Papa Doo, my sweet embraceable you. Many charms about you. Above all, I want these arms about you. So don't be a naughty baby. Come to Papa Doo, my sweet embrace.
Frank Sinatra singing Embraceable You in 1947. Music by George Gershwin, lyrics by Ira Gershwin. What have you come to realise, as you've begun to get old, about the things that we can all expect in our 80s?
To forget. Sorry. I'm very bad. I don't remember names and faces.
Is it short-term memory largely?
With me, it's more complicated. You know, I bump into people in the street and they greet me and I just don't know who they are until they tell me. And then I can remember. And I lose names. So it's memory for me is a major issue, yes. It doesn't affect my work particularly. It's more social aspects.
And physically, you have written about how we can expect quite good things in life.
I think if you keep taking exercise, I think it's very important to keep physically fit. And it also, there is some evidence that it does avoid Alzheimer's and dementia. And one of the things about, you know, one's body, I'm afraid, with ageing does deteriorate a bit. And that's not very good.
A composer who represents passion at its most powerful, I suppose, is Wagner.
Yes. I am very strongly drawn to Wagner. Why is a puzzle. And I love going to the Ring every now and then. And it really is. I think he's just absolutely remarkable. The fact that he's sort of slightly Nazified and sort of anti-Jewish, I'm afraid I just tend to ignore. I try to understand why I'm so impressed with him, but I don't have a good explanation, but I find it very moving and totally involving.
So the fact that he might have had qualities as a man that you wouldn't particularly take to,
yes,
doesn't really matter given what he managed to produce.
I'm only interested in the music. I mean, it's very strange and very powerful, the music. The extraordinary story of Siegfried being stabbed in the back and how the ring was stolen back from him and so forth, and the influence of the ring. I know it's all mystical nonsense, but nevertheless, it's extremely powerful. And when one's in a concert of the ring, the music simply overwhelms one.
So you just submit to it? You don't bother to try and analyse it?
No, I don't analyse it.
Siegfried's Death and Funeral March from Wagner's Götterdämmerung, played by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. You've suffered from pretty serious depression, Lewis Wolpert, and you've written about that.
I had very serious depression. I was hospitalised. I never used music to cheer me up, I must confess. And although I know that music is used quite widely now for people with anxiety and depression, mine was complete blackness. In fact, I claim that in the situation was, if you could describe what you went through, you didn't have it because it's indescribable. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Did you ever work out what triggered it or what it might be about?
No, never knew. And I still take an antidepressant every day. It's 15 years ago since I had my depression. But I'm doing all right now.
Do you think it could have been, therefore, simply a chemical thing?
No idea. Sorry, I wish I knew. I was happily married, I was doing all right, and I was certainly sure I was changing some medication, but I never found out what it was.
When you think of death, we've just heard that funeral music, does that bring on feelings of depression, or is that something completely different?
No, death doesn't bring on depression, no.
So do you believe that anything... And will there be a pearly gates for you or just a blackness again?
Just a blackness, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. No pearly gates, no. No mysticism in me whatsoever, I regret to say. I'm not religious. I have also written a book in which I try to understand the origin of religion, so I'm interested in that.
Do you think that man looks for religion because of some quest, some need, some yearning in us that makes us... I mean, maybe the same thing that you get from Wagner is what some people get from religion.
I think some people get a great deal from religion. It really helps a lot of people. I also think that there is a religious bit in our brains that leads to mystical thinking, yes, quite easily.
And in fact, there is a connection there, I can see, with something like Wagner, where you submit to something which you're not quite sure about.
I think that's true,
yes. You suspend some sort of belief and you're taken on a voyage.
That's a nice way of thinking about it, yes. We do have mystical minds.
Next, it's Mozart, and from The Marriage of Figaro. And what have you chosen?
Well, I chose, funny enough, quite unintentionally, I was taken by my daughter and son-in-law to Glyndebourne to see The Marriage of Figaro. And I happened to choose this one, which is the Countess and Susanna singing together, plotting to do something to trick the Count because he's behaving badly.
Sull'aria, che suave zeffiretto, from Act 3 of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, sung by Véronique Jeans and Patricia Cioffi, with the concerto Köln, conducted by René Jacobs. To turn and finish on a slightly more optimistic note, Lewis Wolpert, you've written quite a bit about happiness pervading later life, that maybe we all come to terms with ourselves, we know who we are, and that a lot of people find happiness and that sex doesn't stop, all of these things which give one reason for optimism.
There is evidence that we're at our least happy in middle age around about the 40s and that many of us are really much happier in our 70s and 80s. I certainly am not, and I'm perfectly happy at this stage. I think a lot depends on one's health. I mean, health really makes the most enormous difference.
Also, you've been fortunate, and of course unfortunate, in that you had a wife that died, but you've been fortunate in having people who loved you and who you love.
Yes. I got divorced from my wife, but we're perfectly friendly at the moment, and I've got a lovely partner at the moment, and then I was married to Jill Neville, who died. Sure.
So really, you are pretty well wagging your tail.
I would say that if I died tomorrow, I've had a very good life, a very good life indeed.
Well,
of course, I've behaved particularly well, but I've had a good life.
Lewis Wolpert, thank you very much for sharing a small part of it with us.
Michael Barclay talking to the scientist Lewis Wolpert. And you may like to know that you can download that programme and many others from the series by going to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website and then follow the links from there. Next week, the actor Michael Sheen will be sharing his musical choices. Private Passions was produced today by Elizabeth Burke, and it's a Loftus production for Radio 3.
In 2010, David Cameron said he'd tackle lobbying.
It's the next big scandal waiting to happen.
Politicians need to declare many of the outside interests that they have.
The question we probably should ask ourselves all the time is, what do our constituents think of this?
But is the system robust enough?
The advisory committee that's supposed to be policing this is run by a group of people who think it's normal to earn very large sums of money as retired MPs.
Declared Interests, the Business of Politics, on BBC Radio 4, tomorrow night at 8.
Well, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to BBC Radio 3 from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here to guide you through our programmes this afternoon. Lars Ulrik Mortensen leads the music making in an hour from now when the Early Music Show takes to the air from our studios in Salford in the northwest of England. Bach, Leclerc and Rameau on the bill. But with the time fast approaching just a minute past one, let's catch up with the news this lunchtime. With the BBC News summary, here's David Cornett.
A legal adviser to the former chief executive of the Liberal Democrats, Lord Rennard, has said Lord Rennard may sue if he's not allowed to represent the party again in the House of Lords. Nick Clegg has said he shouldn't have the whip restored unless he apologises over allegations of sexual harassment. A party investigation found the claims could not be proved. A mother from Edinburgh will appear in court tomorrow to face charges in connection with the death of her three-year-old son, Mikhail. Rosdeep Kular was questioned after his body was found at Kirkcaldy, around 20 miles from their home. Police on the Caribbean island of St Lucia say a 62-year-old man from Warwickshire died protecting his wife from a gang who'd boarded their yacht. They're questioning two men about the attack on Roger and Margaret Pratt. The couple were attacked while sailing round the world. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has announced plans to give consumer groups a role in developing competition policy. He said many markets were currently broken, allowing the public to be ripped off. The business lobby group, the CBI, has condemned the proposal, saying existing regulators should be allowed to work without interference. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has told the BBC that he isn't prejudiced against gay people in any way. The Russian parliament recently passed laws allowing fines for anyone who gave children information about homosexuality. But Mr. Putin insisted that he didn't care about a person's sexual orientation and was friends with gay people. The middle distance runner, Sir Christopher Chataway, has died at the age of 82. He ran in two Olympics and set the pace for Roger Bannister to break the 4-minute mile for the first time. Christopher Chataway then pursued a career in the media and politics. Cricket: Australia have taken an unassailable 3-0 lead in the one-day series against England. The hosts won the latest game in Sydney by 7 wickets with 10 overs to spare. And the weather: there'll be sunny periods in many places this afternoon, but scattered heavy showers in western areas, mainly around coasts. BBC News and weather at 3 minutes past one.
And that was David Cornett. Later this afternoon, if you're a fan of Albrecht Dürer, then you're in for something of a treat. A great fan of Dürer, Charlotte Higgins, will be offering you a tour through his life and his work and what he achieved in his lifetime. Printing was common by then, but what Dürer did was rather akin to the pioneers of social media today. He managed to break down the walls and made art available to the masses. And what art! A master at life drawing and a brilliant engraver. Albrecht Dürer, Printing Press native, is our Sunday feature this evening. It begins at 7:15 here on Radio 3. But next this afternoon, we're off to the Sage in Gateshead to hear two members of Radio 3's New Generation Artists scheme celebrating women of distinguished courage and ability whose noble efforts proved profoundly inspiring. A programme of songs by Ravel, Haydn and Schubert in the main, sung by the soprano Clara Morith with Joseph Middleton at the piano. Well, they're going to begin, as they will end, in Spain, and a song by the 17th century Spanish composer Antonio Literes. As much a competent string player as he was a composer, he rose to prominence as a musician at the Chapel Royal under the Bourbon king, Philip V. Literes was there when a great fire destroyed much of the chapel's music library, so he was well placed to make amends and dived into a feverish period to compose a great quantity of new music to fill the enormous gap which had been left by the fire. But he also worked in the theatre, and this first song is a product of that particular aspect of his career. An aria sung by the water nymph Galatea, reflecting that a song about love can so easily turn to grief. Galatea's aria to a songbird whose song mixes pleasure with grief, conjured by the Spanish composer Antonio Literes and sung there by Clara Morith with Joseph Middleton at the piano. Lovely way in which the piano conjures the sound of that birdsong in that piece. Well, Handel famously turned his hand to that story of Acis and Galatea, just as Richard Strauss would later take the legend of Ariadne auf Naxos to create his memorable opera. But just like Handel, He wasn't the first. Haydn got there a couple of centuries before him, in 1789, in fact, when he used the story as the setting for a solo cantata, a piece that fast became one of Haydn's best-loved compositions at the time. It was performed for Lord Nelson when he and his Lady Hamilton were guests at the Esterházy Palace 10 years later. It begins with a reflective passage as Ariadne awakes. Listen out for the dawn in a big crescendo on the piano. Then Ariadne begs the gods to bring her lover Theseus, and we hear the fact that she climbs the cliff as she realises that she's been abandoned. First she becomes desperate, then angry. Then she can't contain her fury before the music comes to, well, a somewhat cynical conclusion, really. Ariadne a Naxos by Haydn.